That's just about it for the Wrecking Hours today. That was, of course, Mike Ness, Social Distortion with Bad Luck. Before that, we heard Cosmic Codfish Jukebox doing Alcoholicost from the Psychomania number 6, released from Halb 7 Records. Also, Rumble Club in that set with The Bad and Me from the title by the same name, released from Wolverine Records. And of course, we heard the Turbo ACs in there with Atomic from Return of the Hot Rod Zombies. And now we're going to close with The Flanders, 51st State, from Grave Robbing, released from Halb 7 Records. Come back next week for more Rockabilly, Psychabilly, and Surf.
Look out of your windows, watch the skies. Read all the instructions with bright blue eyes. WISPF, proud American son. We know how to clean our teeth and how to swift on a gun. We're the state of America.
Yeah, we are
the state of America.
This is
the state of America. A star-spangled Union Jack for the so proud. Over the dancing hats of the merry patriotic crowd. Tip your hat to the Yankees conquerors. We've got no rest under the bed. We've guns on our pillows, we're the
States of America.
Yeah, we are States of America.
This is the
States of America. Whoa. Here in the land of your unity, watch us revel in our liberty. You can say what you like, but it doesn't change anything. Cause the corridors of our and the road and why we're
the States of America.
Yeah, we are
the States of America.
This is it.
What's the most important position in the NFL? Hands down, it's the designated driver. The guy who makes the winning drive home from the stadium safe and sound. The guy all the other guys depend on to stay sober. The guy who might be a guy, might be a gal, but is always a winner. Sign up to be that guy at the designated driver booth in the stadium. A message from your fans at MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Visit us at mad.org.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
Metro Detroit is going down every single Monday night, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. It's Zone Radio with Richardson, D.C., only here at 89.3. The station making waves across the Great Lakes, WHFR.FM. That's right, Detroit's longest-running hip-hop show, The Zone Radio with Richardson, D.C.
Yes, folks, hi, this is Wayne Hancock, and you're listening to WHFR, Dearborn, Michigan. Hope you dig it, man.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, Beth Terry joins us to talk about her new book, Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. We'll also talk with Ken Winston, the policy advocate for Nebraska's Sierra Club chapter, about wind power in Nebraska. And Avital Andrews from Sierra Magazine shares some green living tips for Thanksgiving. Joining us now is Beth Terry. She's the author of a new book called Plastic Free, How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and You Can Too. Welcome.
Hi.
It's great to have you on the show. We've been following your blog for a while, too. Before you wrote this book, you had a blog chronicling your attempt to live a plastic-free life. How did you first get interested in this topic? What was it that made you feel like you wanted to take on plastic?
Well, it was actually a photo that I saw 5 years ago in 2007. I was browsing the internet and I stumbled across an article about the plastic pollution problem in the ocean. And at that time, I didn't realize that that was a problem. And what I saw was a photo of a dead albatross chick on Midway Island, whose body was just full of ordinary plastic pieces like bottle caps and things that I was using on a regular basis. And I was utterly shocked because I hadn't realized until then that my personal everyday choices were having an impact on creatures like thousands of miles from civilization. And what I read in the article was that mama birds fly out over the ocean to gather food for their chicks, and they mistake plastic for food and bring it back. And this is thousands of miles from any people. So our plastic is making it out there. And I just decided I had to do something about it. So I decided to try to see what it would be like to live without acquiring any new plastic. And I really just wanted to do it for my own information. And it turned into a blog and it turned into a book now.
Now, were there other things besides the wildlife impacts that also seemed to you to be wrong with plastic? Or did you, you know, along the way begin to get involved in some of those other impacts too, like the pollution from the manufacturing of plastic and all of those problems?
Well, especially PVC plastic is extremely dangerous when it's produced. But one of the things about plastic that is of such concern to me is that it's full of all kinds of different additives. When you look at the bottom of a container and you see the number in the triangle, that tells you what the type of plastic it is, but it doesn't tell you what else has been added to it. In addition to the things we know about, like bisphenol A and phthalates, which are hormone disruptors, there are thousands of other chemicals that can be added to plastic to affect its qualities, you know, the strength or the hardness or the slipperiness. And manufacturers aren't required to disclose what any of those chemicals are, and all of those chemicals can leach out. And so if we as consumers don't know what they are, we can't know they're safe. And there actually have been some BPA replacements that are being found to be just as hormone disrupting as BPA. So for me, without the full disclosure from the manufacturers, I don't think any plastic is safe.
And by safety, you mean not just how it's made and the people who live near the factories and facilities where it's made, but also all of us who are eating food out of plastic containers,
right,
and drinking water out of plastic.
That's right. And when you know, talking about the people who live near the factories, you know, people ask me all the time what kind of plastic is safe. And I say, you know, even if a particular plastic isn't leaching into your food and drink, which it probably is, but even if it isn't, the people who live near the petrochemical plant where that plastic was manufactured were basically being poisoned. Because even PET, the kind of plastic that ordinary water bottles are made out of, it's made with some really nasty chemicals.
What is in plastic? What does it take to actually take oil and petroleum products and make them into the plastics that we use?
Well, plastic is made not just from petroleum. A lot of people think that it's just oil, but in this country, a lot of plastic is also made from natural gas. And I have not been to a plastic manufacturer to see exactly how it's cracked and all that. But for example, there are chemicals like benzene and toluamine and paraxylene and all kinds of chemicals like that that are used to make plastics. And So there isn't really any safe plastic.
Well, let's talk about some of the experiences that you had along the way as you tried to live a plastic-free life. How does one do that in a world where everything seems to come in plastic? And what was that like for you?
Well, how to do it is step by step. I would say don't try to do it all at once. So what I did, I wanted to know what my personal plastic footprint was, too. So I started collecting all my plastic waste each week to see how much I was using. And as I would use things up, I didn't go through and purge all the plastic from my kitchen. I used things up, and then I would try to find an alternative. I started with plastic grocery bags because that just seemed like the easiest thing to me, carrying my own reusable bag instead of taking a plastic bag at the store. And then I also got a reusable stainless steel water bottle, and I just stopped buying plastic bottled beverages altogether. And then from there, my next step was to stop taking disposable takeout restaurant ware. So I got a little bamboo utensil set that I carry with me everywhere. I got some reusable containers that I bring with me. And especially, you know, if I'm going to a restaurant and I might have leftovers, I'll bring a stainless steel container with me to put them in instead of styrofoam or some other kind of disposable foodware. And then in terms of grocery shopping, I like to support stores that sell food in bulk bins and also the local farmers market. But with the bulk bins, I can bring my own bags and I can bring my own containers and fill those up and not have any packaging. I actually did an interview with a woman who works for Whole Foods who explained to me how the bulk bins are set up and how they're sanitized and why they're safe to use, which was really interesting. And then after that, it's just been research, doing a lot of research. And the main reason that I wanted to write a book was because I had done so much research, which is really the part of living plastic-free that takes so much time. And so I wanted to save other people that time trying to figure out how to do it and just sort of give them the manual that I wish I'd had when I was first doing this.
What are some of the things that were really hard to replace that you couldn't find plastic-free? I mean, did you have guilty pleasures? Was there a certain, you know, a lipstick that only comes with a plastic container or something like that that you just didn't know how to get around?
I confess, and I say this in the book, too, that I was a convenience food addict, and I lived on frozen microwavable meals and energy bars, and I did not want to have to learn how to cook. I just wanted to eat fast. And so that was the hardest thing. And so when I first started, I was sure that I was going to be able to find a frozen food that didn't come in a plastic container. And so I bought almost every frozen food you can imagine just to see what was inside the box. And what I found out was even the ones that come in a cardboard carton inside the box, those cartons are lined with plastic because that's what makes them leak-proof. So even ice cream containers, milk cartons, all of those things are lined with plastic. So I had to learn how to eat better, basically. I had to learn how to eat whole, fresh foods, and that has been an added bonus in all of this.
Do you feel healthier now? Did you find that you ended up losing weight as a result? I mean, were there other side benefits?
I really wish I could say that I'd lost weight. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Well, I just wonder, I mean, because I feel like when you have to eat things that are plastic-free, it seems like you're basically limited to just eating fruits and vegetables and, you know, things that come not, that are not packaged. And I wonder if that, you know,
well,
also
Well, I have to tell you that Berkeley Bowl sells pasta in bulk.
Mm.
And that's not really conducive to losing weight. And the bulk bins have all kinds of yummy snacks, like chocolate-covered almonds.
Right.
So I have actually not felt deprived at all. Mm-hmm. And I have not lost weight, but it's not because of plastic. It's because I need to go out and exercise more.
Well, let's get back to kicking the plastic habit, because I'm wondering, what are some things that have plastic in it that people don't even realize, besides the plastic lining on milk cartons, which I never thought of before?
Yeah, and most people think that that's wax, but it hasn't been waxed since the 50s. The most surprising one, well, there's two. The very most surprising one to me was chewing gum. I had no idea. I guess I didn't really think about what chewing gum was made out of in the first place, but
it has plastic in it?
Yeah, the gum base, if you look at the ingredients on a chewing gum package, it'll say gum base. And it doesn't tell you what the gum base is. And most gum base now is a type of plastic. And even a natural chewing gum like Glee, which is advertised as being made from natural chicle from a rubber tree, it also contains plastic, polyvinyl acetate. And I confirmed that with the owner of the company, actually. So there are a couple of completely natural chewing gums, but for the most part, chewing gum is plastic. And then the other thing that shocked me that people are just learning about is that a lot of facial scrubs contain tiny polyethylene beads that are meant to exfoliate your skin. And it's little tiny plastic beads that are just meant to be washed down the drain and are making it out into the ocean. And apparently a lot of these beads have been found in the Great Lakes recently. I don't know if they use more exfoliating scrubs around the Great Lakes or what, but that I found out a few years ago, and it's still going on, and it's a big problem because microplastics like that get mixed in with the plankton at the bottom of the food chain, and they end up rising up the food chain.
Well, I imagine they end up in the fish that people eat on their dinner plates.
And at that point, they're much more toxic because plastic in the ocean acts like a sponge for oil-based pollutants. And so they're finding little tiny plastic pieces that are full of DDT and PCB and things like that. And that's what the fish are eating. So it's getting into the fish. That means it's getting into us.
How did you make sure that the book itself was plastic-free?
Well, the credit completely goes to my publisher. Because honestly, when I wrote my book proposal and started sending it out, I didn't even think about hardback books being made with plastic. But they did. And they said, we want to publish your book and we want to do it without any plastic, which means no coating on the cover, no plastic glue, no plastic polyester thread. They really looked into all of it. And when you open the box, there's no plastic packaging material in the case when they shipped the books to me. Unfortunately, they didn't tell the printer not to put plastic tape on the boxes. So there was that. But they did everything they could think of to try to make sure that there wasn't plastic in the book itself.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from people about this? Are you inspiring other people to try the plastic-free journey?
Yes. I'm only getting positive feedback. So far, I've been waiting for the negative feedback, and I haven't gotten any. A lot of people write to me and say, tell me about changes that they've made in their own lives. Some people are taking my plastic Show Your Plastic Challenge, which is to collect your plastic trash for a week or more and then tally it up and answer some questions. And if you want to, you can take a picture and post it on my website and answer the questions on the website. And then other people may be able to leave comments and give suggestions. If you say, well, what could I do about this? What could I use instead of that?
What's been the most surprising part about becoming a plastics expert and anti-plastics advocate?
I think the most surprising part is how committed I still feel to this after 5 years. And other people have asked me that question before, and for some reason, none of this surprises me. I think I was meant to do this in some way. And even giving interviews and talking in public and giving presentations and stuff, I guess I never would have seen myself doing these things, but it just feels like my purpose at this point. You know, it just feels like, of course I'm doing this.
And are you going to continue to do the blog as well?
The blog is still ongoing, and people can subscribe to it. It's myplasticfreelife.com. However, I have not been blogging as frequently as I did in the beginning because I just don't have time with promoting the book and giving presentations and stuff like that. But I do have lots of ideas for things that I would like to put up on there. So if people want to follow along, that's great.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Yeah, there is one thing. We need activists. We need people to go out and push their legislators and push companies to change. And it's possible. You know, we can get companies to change because we do have a voice. But I think it's important for us to start with ourselves and look at what responsibility each of us has in the choices that we make. But we have to go further than that. We can't just stop at the grocery store.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Beth Terry. She's the author of a new book called Plastic Free: How I Kicked the Plastic Habit and How You Can Too. Joining us now is Ken Winston. He's the policy advocate for the Nebraska Sierra Club chapter. Welcome.
Hi.
We're really glad to have you on the show. We've been hearing a lot about the energy landscape in Nebraska right now. It's actually a pretty exciting place to be with a lot of potential for wind. Tell us a little bit more about what you see from your position.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about Nebraska is the fact that we have so much potential to really do a lot with wind and solar, and we could do so much better with energy conservation. And so it was really exciting, the fact that we put together a report that laid out some of the potential that we could capture if we do some of those things.
Now, the report says that investments in wind energy in Nebraska could create up to 14,000 new jobs. And I thought that even more so than that, what I thought was interesting was that it talks about saving businesses and consumers literally billions of dollars. What kind of investments would the state's public power districts have to make in the next few years in order to create those kind of jobs and reach the savings that you talk about in the report?
We haven't really detailed all of those numbers. We don't lay out how the investment process would go. But one of the interesting things about wind development is that wind development is in Nebraska, like most other states, is mostly done by private developers, and they take advantage of the production tax credits, and so the utilities themselves don't have to lay out the investment for wind to be developed in Nebraska, and there are a number of developers that are interested in doing that.
So Nebraska has huge wind potential. I've seen it listed as being fourth in the nation, but it looks like it's lagging behind some of the surrounding states like Iowa and South Dakota and Colorado and Kansas.
We're last.
Yeah, so why is that? I mean, how can Nebraska catch up to all the neighboring states? Where's the friendly competition here in the region?
Well, actually, it's one of those things where I think if they just turned it over to the people, and of course, we are a public power state, so it would make sense if they would follow the will of the people. But if people want to see more wind developed, there was a wind conference in Lincoln, which is the capital of Nebraska. There was a wind conference for 2 days, and almost everybody talked about the economic potential, the fact that wind doesn't use water, the fact that wind is approved by 90% of the people of the state, and so really, the only thing that's holding it back is the fact that the people who are running our public power districts haven't gotten in line with the people they represent.
Now, some states are getting more than 20% of their energy from wind. I know that Iowa and South Dakota are both getting more than 20% currently from wind. What's it going to take for Nebraska to be able to get 20% or more of its energy from wind?
I think a big part of it is just a matter of the political will for the representatives on the public power districts and the public power district management to come to the conclusion that this is something that this is what their constituents want, and that they ought to be following through with that. But part of it is making the case for it, and they've lagged behind because they've been using a lot of outdated reasons and what I'd say excuses to avoid developing wind.
Now, I feel like after this past summer with such horrible drought and so many ranchers and farmers really suffering as a result, has that been a factor? Has that been a topic in this conversation? Because wind power is one of the forms of generating power that really doesn't use any water. And is that something that Nebraskans are interested in?
Yes, definitely. One of the presentations talked about the billions of gallons of water that are used by power plants. And the people of Nebraska, since it's an agricultural state, they understand that basically that water is life, that if you don't have water, you don't have a crop, you can't water your livestock, and they understand the importance of water. And so there's, I think this is one of the issues that's going to help drive people to want to develop more wind as an energy source.
Anything else in the report that you think our listeners would be interested in?
the idea that there's large benefits from energy efficiency, I think that's another, I mean, that's part of the way that the report is suggesting that in addition to investing in wind, that we also need to make better use of our energy. And we did a press conference last week, and one of the things that one of the speakers brought up was just the fact that our ancestors wouldn't dream of wasting anything because they knew how precious everything was that they had. I mean, the people that settled the plains, the Native Americans who lived here before we came here, they knew how valuable everything was, and you didn't waste anything. And now we waste 60 to 70% of the electricity that we generate, and we think nothing of it. Well, we can't afford to do that anymore. And we probably really never could afford to do it, but economically, we need to make better use of the electricity that we generate, and it's going to have huge benefits for us by reducing the amount of electricity that we have to generate, and if we can make people's homes more comfortable, safer, as well as reducing the energy use. And on top of that, you reduce their electric bills, so they've got more money to put back into the economy in other ways. I think the bottom line of the report that came out was that there's some huge economic benefits that we're not taking advantage of. The first is the wind, and the wind, if you've ever been to Nebraska, you know that the wind blows here all the time. I mean, that's one of the things that people complain about is how much the wind blows. So we might as well harness some of that energy and make good use of it. So wind and efficiency are a way of growing and making small rural communities vital again.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Ken Winston, the policy advocate for Nebraska's Sierra Club chapter. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Arlie.
We are going to talk today about green Thanksgiving tips.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've been doing this show now for almost 5 years, so we've had a number of Thanksgivings. Every year we come up with some new, different tips. What should we be thinking about this year when it comes to green Thanksgivings?
Right. Well, last year, I think I mentioned the vegetarian option. There's always tofurkey, and it's just something to keep in mind.
Tofurkey is a tofu turkey, right?
Yeah. It's not really tofu, but it's made of a soy meat mm-hmm. alternative. And it's just something to keep in mind. I know a lot of people really don't like to give up the idea of having turkey for Thanksgiving, but if you're a vegetarian and if you're willing to consider that option, it will help with the 10 billion pounds of manure that America's 7,000 turkey farms crank out every year. So that's one option.
Yeah, I do think a lot of people, think about turkey and green issues as being, oh, maybe I'll get an organic turkey. But I don't think people realize that the factory farms that produce those birds actually create a huge environmental impact.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are going with the bird, if you are doing the meat, if you're an omnivore and you must have your meat on Thanksgiving, then choose an organic bird. You're going to have fewer hormones, fewer synthetic chemicals in the animal, in your body, and ultimately in the earth. So that's one way to avoid the problems of the big factory farms. And going for locally raised birds from local family farms is another good way to not feed that polluting beast that is the livestock industry. And if you want to go more humane, you can choose a free-range or a cage-free bird as well.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the yummy vegetarian side dishes you can make for Thanksgiving. I mean, what do you recommend? There's a lot people can do.
Yeah, there's a lot that you can do. I mean, really, there aren't that many side dishes for Thanksgiving that aren't vegetarian. You know, you can replace chicken stock for vegetable stock anywhere. Mm-hmm. So that's an easy way to make all your side dishes vegetarian. You might want to check out your farmer's market, see what's seasonal and local. That's always a great way to go green with any food is don't make people have to consume the transit costs of the food and just support your local farms. That's a great way to do it.
Okay, so food, Thanksgiving goes hand in hand, but people also like to decorate
yeah.
their Thanksgiving table. So what can you do in terms of green decor?
I think the first thing you need to decide is not to buy your Thanksgiving decorations new. And, you know, when you think Thanksgiving decorations, you think of cornucopia, and that's a great centerpiece to use found objects for. Fallen pine cones, autumn leaves, seasonal fruits and vegetables that you'll later eat. So just, you know, using found objects and not necessarily buying kind of like a big plastic turkey to put on your table, not to mention that that's tacky to begin with. And then, you know, for just the more general decorations, or the table setting, you'll want to use a real tablecloth, not a plastic one, which, again, also looks and feels better. And then for flatware and silverware, just stay away from the single-use disposables. You use them one time, and then they're in the landfill forever. So, you know, if you're having a lot of people over, try to use the normal kind of forks and knives. And but if you have to use throwaway place settings for convenience, you're having a ton of people over and you just can't use the reusable kind, then there are some good bamboo options, actually, that are better than plastic.
Now, what about travel? Thanksgiving is one of the year's biggest travel events. And obviously that comes with a little bit of, green guilt for some people. So what can you do in that realm?
Absolutely. This is one of the biggies for travel. So if you're flying to see family or friends, you can offset your airfare. Two good websites to do that are carbonfund.org and terrapass.com. If you're planning a long distance drive, this is another one of those holidays where you'll drive and drive to see your family or friends. So do what you can to carpool, and you can... If you're open to shared rides, you can find one on zimride.com. That's a website specifically for that. Or you can go onto Craigslist. But if you do that, then just use common sense in regard to safety. And if you have some kind of weird gut feeling, don't do it. But, you know, carpool when you can. And if you're close enough to use public transit, that's a great option. If you're far, too, you can use Amtrak or the train. A lot of times, trains will be going right where you are, and the train's going to be going there anyway, so you might as well be on it and save the car or airplane emissions. And if you are really close, you can bike or walk there and back. Human-powered options are always best of all, and you'll get bonus points for burning off some of that feast after you've consumed it.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine, with her Green Thanksgiving Tips.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Hello again, podcast listeners. Here's your periodic secret message that we drop in for you folks. A word about our Carl Sagan Day celebration on Friday, November 9. It was terrific. It was one of the greatest evenings of my professional life, really probably just of my life, period. Today's show captures just a few excerpts from that, as you'll hear. There is so much more. I really cannot recommend it highly enough. The sad thing is that our video was lost. The live webcast failed, as some of you probably know, only about 2 minutes in. And we thought that we still had a video recording to rely on. Well, unfortunately, our friends at Southern California Public Radio said that was lost as well. We're still not really sure what happened. Thank goodness we had an audio recording to create this radio show and to put the entire evening up at planetary.org, where you can find this radio show. We'll have a link there, but I think it's also on the homepage. And our friend Liam Kennedy, he had his still camera there, and he took some terrific pictures. And so it's a kind of a pseudo video that I hope you'll enjoy. It was assembled by my colleague Casey Dreyer. Anyway, here is our celebration of Sagan Day and our 10th anniversary, as you'll hear during the What's Up segment, also done in front of that audience at Southern California Public Radio's Crawford Family Forum. As I mentioned last week, we still welcome your support. You can donate directly to Planetary Radio. And if you give us over $50 to support this show, we'll give you a Planetary Radio T-shirt. And I stand by my offer. Anybody who gives us $5,000 or more, I will come to your hometown and buy you dinner. Thanks for listening. A celebration of Carl Sagan and our 10th anniversary this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Carl Sagan was born on November 9, 1934. Before his all-too-early death, he would do some great science, and he would change the public face of science. That's why we gathered in Pasadena on the evening of November 9th to talk with some of Carl's closest friends and to hear from young scientists he inspired. We're only able to bring you a handful of highlights on today's show. You can hear the entire more than 90-minute event and enjoy great photos by Liam Kennedy at planetary.org. It includes Emily Lakdawalla, a cameo appearance by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and a blind date many years ago that eventually led to a movie called Interstellar that is currently in development. We began with a welcoming message from the science guy.
Hi, everyone. Bill Nye here from the Planetary Society. Thank you for coming to help celebrate Sagan Day 2012. Now, you know, I had Carl Sagan for astronomy for one class, and then I corresponded him a little bit after I got out of engineering school, and the guy changed my life. And I imagine the reason you're all here is because he touched your lives as well. So it's a wonderful thing that we celebrate his legacy. And for me, the big message that Carl wanted to share with the world was that science is this process, this way we know our place among the stars, our place in space. And the process not only leads to these remarkable discoveries, but it brings out the best in us. It's what humans do best. And so it's worth celebrating. So thank you all for being here. And I believe I would paraphrase Professor Sagan by saying, let's change the world.
Carl Sagan, former JPL Director Bruce Murray, and Emeritus Planetary Society Executive Director Lou Friedman founded the Society 32 years ago. Lou joined me on stage to share his memories and pay tribute to Carl.
At the beginning, we were kind of trying to feel our way. What were we going to do? But we got great support in the planetary community. Carl wrote some awfully good letters to important people for support, to fellow scientists. And most of all, he intellectually guided the organization. We didn't know what we were going to be. We had no idea. Remember, hours of discussions, usually arguments.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you obviously all had a lot of respect for each other, but I have it on good authority that you were, we'll call it, strong advocates for your diverse positions and opinions. I wish I'd been around to watch one of those arguments.
Well, Carl and Bruce had strong positions. I never did. And it's really true. I can remember hammering out positions that we were going to take with Congress or writing congressional testimony or advocacy that we were going to do in public op-eds or something like that. It was very hard work. To get one sentence done sometimes, it would take several hours of discussion, usually on telephones or payphones in some place or another. Carl and Bruce were famous for being rivals and advocates of very different positions. Bruce Murray had, and with due respect to the people here in the audience, the somewhat more conservative Caltech position about being skeptical of some of the discoveries that were being made and some of the speculations about those discoveries. Carl would keep us, as some people said, at the edge of speculation. And so the two of them would be arguing about the interpretation. Carl, you shouldn't have said it this way. And Carl would say, was there anything incorrect about it? And they would go back and forth on this for quite some time. But the interesting thing is they were absolutely identical in their determination of what we should do and how we should do it. Mm-hmm. And it all came out, as you can see, with the Planetary Society, but also with so many other products of space missions and great agreements.
And here we are 32 years later.
Yeah, this, by the way, I want to congratulate you on the 10th anniversary of the radio show. I think Bruce Betts pointed out earlier other anniversaries that this is connected with, but this is also the 8th anniversary of the launch of the Venus Express. And that's kind of interesting that anniversary on this date coincides with the date of Carl's birthday, because it was Venus that launched Carl Sagan's scientific career. His early scientific work was on the studying of the Venus atmosphere and the implications of the very heavy atmosphere, which led to the creation of a greenhouse, and not just a greenhouse, but a runaway greenhouse, which led to, of course, so much of his work in the whole subject of planetary atmospheres and climate change and all of those subjects.
Kip Thorne has been with Caltech in Pasadena for over 45 years. He was named Richard Feynman Professor of Theoretical Physics more than 20 years ago. Now, in a busy retirement, he is working with another friend of Carl Sagan's, producer Linda Obst, on that movie I mentioned called Interstellar. Kip met Carl in the 1960s, and they became lifelong friends.
By most accounts, Carl was a really smart guy.
He was.
Okay. Yeah, that was a joke. But when he needed to get a fictional character to the other end of the galaxy in 10 minutes or less, you were the guy he called. Were you already acquainted?
Oh, yes. I knew Carl since before you did, Lou. We go back to about 1970. He had just recently moved to Cornell. I was going back and forth between Cornell and Caltech every now and then. I was based at Caltech, but I often visited Cornell, and I got acquainted with him there when I was visiting my colleagues who were also working in similar fields in astrophysics. And then he was spending time out here on the Pioneer 10 mission and then the Pioneer 11 mission, which presaged Voyager. And so I would see him out here. We just became very good friends, although we were working at opposite ends of astrophysics.
Did he just call you up one day and say, I'm writing this book called Contact, and I need a way to get somebody from point A to point B?
And no, he called me up and he said, I have written this book named Contact. It's in page proofs, but I'm feeling a little uneasy about some of the science of how you get from here to Vega. I have my crew, which included the heroine who became Jodie Foster. I had my crew going through a black hole, and I know you're not going to like that. Can you help me rework it?
Yeah, and
get him out of the hole.
Yeah, dig him out of the hole, the black hole. I shouldn't have said across the galaxy. I forgot. It's Vega, which is not too far, right?
So he sent me, by overnight express mail, a copy of the whole book. My daughter was just graduating from UC Santa Cruz, I guess the day after that, and so I rode in a car up to Santa Cruz for my daughter's graduation, read the book, and struggled, well, how do we make this honest? Because Carl's specialty was not general relativity. It was not curved space-time. So I realized that what he really needed was a wormhole to travel through rather than a black hole. But I also realized, just did some back-of-the-envelope calculations on the trip, and there's a major problem how you hold a wormhole open so it won't implode on itself. And so I sent him a few pages of calculations and a discussion of these issues. So he actually rewrote, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 pages of that book in page proof, which did not make his publisher very happy. In order to change from traveling through a black hole to traveling through a wormhole.
Had you given any consideration to this theoretical possibility prior to hearing from Carl?
Well, the idea of wormholes goes back a long time to Ludwig Flam, 1 year after Einstein formulated his general relativity theory. So I was well aware of it. My mentor, John Wheeler at Princeton, had thought some about wormholes and had realized that they will implode on themselves if you don't do something to hold them open. He didn't speculate about what was required to hold them open. But wormholes were such far out ideas that I don't think anybody, and certainly not me, were paying much attention to wormholes at that stage. We were more interested in things that we were sure are out there, like quasars and how quasars can be powered by black holes. And so, no, none of us were thinking about wormholes until Carl called me.
And I've read that this led to a whole new line of theoretical physics investigation, which may continue today.
Yeah, so Carl sort of broke my mental block of not wanting to think about this. And so I began to think seriously, can a wormhole be held open? How do you hold it open? And then I realized, you know, we're thinking about issues in warped space and time that are far, far, far beyond what we as human beings can ever do in the laboratory. And yet, thinking about these questions of can a very advanced civilization hold a wormhole open and travel through it, that is a thought experiment. And working on mathematical calculations with the laws of physics to find answers, that's a powerful way to do research. It focuses the mind on specific issues. You come to realize what is it that governs whether or not wormholes are possible or whether or not time travel is possible. And that leads you, as you struggle to answer those questions from the laws of physics, leads you to a much deeper understanding of the nature of space and time. So I started publishing in this field, and when I started publishing, my close friend Igor Novikov in Moscow phoned me up with great joy. He says, if you can publish about this, then so can I. I've wanted to for years, but it was never respectable. And so it's now more or less respectable. It has become a very serious direction of research, but it really is all due to Carl breaking our mental block, we as a community who work on these issues of warp space and time.
Linda Obst was a science writer for the New York Times who suddenly found herself in a strange new land called Hollywood. She was overjoyed when best friends Carl Sagan and Andruyan came to town to work on the Voyager mission and Carl's amazing public TV series called Cosmos. It wasn't long before they had begun to create the film version of Carl's best-selling book, Contact. Linda was Contact's executive producer and went on to produce many other terrific movies.
And I'm a total Saganite. That's my sort of religion, I call it, if I had a religion. He taught me that the truth, the laws of physics, are more interesting than anything we can make up. In the movie, the narrative is informed not just by a great story, which it is, but by the rule that nothing, no plot point, can defy the laws of physics. And just like when he was turning in his galleys, he had to get it right and called Kip and changed the galleys.
You told me that there were other ways in which he participated, something about Carl participated, something about workshops.
Well, what we did is that we began the project before we even had a screenplay, the movie. We had a book, right, but we didn't have the movie yet. We hired the director, and we had a series of workshops where we invited experts in every field that the movie involved, from futurism to religion versus science to planetary astronomy to wormholes. Kip was part of the workshop so that we could draw up the wormholes for our production designer and so our director could understand them. Every expert that Carl could identify, which he really could, sat with us for maybe 2 days or 3 days each, and we transcribed them with a court stenographer. And we sat, and we had a hotel. We were in a hotel room. We sat through lunch. We worked all day, and I have the most incredible set of transcripts. And we debated, we talked, we milked, and plumbed the depths of every expert we could in all these fields. So before the writing began, both the writer and the director, and Annie and I got in there too, interrogated and imagined every possible facet of the ideas conceivable in every aspect of the material of the film.
Linda Obst, executive producer of the movie Contact and a close friend of Carl Sagan's. We've got more to our Carl Sagan Day celebration and our 10th anniversary edition of What's Up when Planetary Radio continues in a minute.
Hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from PlanetFest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from, and are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do, and together we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the world.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Planetary Radio's celebration of Carl Sagan continues. I'm Matt Kaplan. Chaz Beichman studies exoplanets, those worlds that orbit distant stars, but he also heads the NASA Exoplanet Science Institute, or NEXSCI, at Caltech.
I think it's really a fantastic time for anyone who's interested in precisely the questions Carl was interested in. Where are the venues for life beyond Earth, whether it's in our solar system or now, as we know, in other solar systems? The very first extrasolar planet, 51 Peg, was discovered just a few months before Carl died in 1996. 51 Peg was discovered in 1995 by the Swiss group, the same group that just a few weeks ago found an Earth-sized planet orbiting one of the closest stars to us, Alpha Centauri B. I think Carl would have been thrilled with all the discoveries, but perhaps that one almost the most. I mean, this is the closest star to us. It's a few light years away. I mean, we could, you know, Voyager, if it was aiming in the right direction, would be there in 40,000 years.
No, we got to get a solar.
Unless Kip intervenes and gets us there quicker. So I think the excitement of that would have thrilled Carl completely. I'll point out that he was on the West Coast just a few months before he died, sitting in the office with me and Charles Alacci, who was soon to become the director of JPL, but then was in charge of doing science missions, was Sarah saying, you know, we ought to do this mission that Bill Borucki up at Ames would like to do called Kepler. And the Kepler mission is now up and has found probably 2,000 or 3,000 candidate planets and is revolutionizing our ideas on planetary systems. At the same time, we are pushing other ways to find planets more close by, identifying planets in the habitable zone, eventually even finding planets where we would find evidence of photosynthetic products in their atmosphere. Terrestrial Planet Finder. So these were all the sorts of things Carl would, I think, really have loved to have seen. We certainly miss his voice helping to push those in the public arena. Through NASA, we select five or six young students who've just graduated from graduate school who are their first steps as young scientists, as postdoctoral fellows, in what we call the Sagan program. We have a picture of Carl, not this one, but another very nice picture, and underneath it says, somewhere something incredible is waiting to be discovered. And there's one of, I think, the favorite quotes I have of Carl's. We get typically 75 to 80 applicants every year. We choose five or six of those students, so it's oversubscribed by, you know, 10, 15 to 1. And these are the best of the best of the best scientists in either theory, observation, or instrument builders, because we want people to actually build the instruments that do the missions that take the next step. We had Ann Druin at the announcement of starting this fellowship program at the American Museum of Natural History. She was there. Neil Tyson hosted the event. And all the students really take something away and learn a little bit about Carl. And I think it's really a great testimony to him.
Chaz Beischman of NEXI, home of the Sagan Fellowship Program. Several of those young fellows were with us for our celebration of Carl Sagan's birthday, and one joined a panel that included our own Emily Lakdawalla. Melissa Rice was also on that panel. She is part of the science team for Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover. Melissa told us how a high school astronomy class, and learning that the sun would eventually die, taking the Earth with it, set her on a path that would be paved for her by Carl Sagan.
And it hit me that, whoa, everything I know, everything I'm studying, history, art, philosophy, everything was going to be gone someday. And what was going to remain? Science. And I had this revelation that the only thing greater than myself is science, and that's what I have to study. So I had this very, you know, it was an intellectual revelation, but it was also an emotional, and I'd call it a spiritual revelation, too. You know, when you're a teenager, you have lots of very strong emotions, and that one might have just been another little blip on my emotional chart at age 16, but I went to the library later, and I was looking for books on astronomy because I had this hunger to learn about it, and I was fortunate enough to pick up Carl's books, and reading Carl's books spoke exactly to what I was feeling. And it might have been a different story if I had picked up a book that was more of an academic astronomy book, because it wasn't facts I was after. It was this sense of something larger than myself, this sense that understanding science can make the experience of being alive better. And so I was fortunate to find Carl's books and to read Broca's Brain and Contact and have a role model of Ellie Arroway as a as a female scientist to studying astronomy and dating Matthew McConaughey. And so I think that really set me on the path that this is what I want to do. This is something worthy of devoting my life to studying.
JPL scientist Melissa Rice, part of our panel of young scientists at the Planetary Society's celebration of Carl Sagan. We thank all our guests and Southern California Public Radio for once again hosting us. Please listen to the entire celebration at planetary.org. I think you'll be inspired. So, live from the Crawford Family Forum at Southern California Public Radio, it's time for What's Up with Dr. Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, Matt. Good to be here again. It's the happy 10th anniversary show.
We won't make you sing. It's okay. Thank you. So tell us, what's up?
We've got in the east pre-dawn, we've got Venus dominating the sky. Saturn starting to come up underneath it, much less bright, but they'll get closer as the weeks go on. And in the mid-evening, we've got Jupiter coming up over in the east, looking exceptionally bright as well. And this week, 1980, Voyager 1 flew past Saturn. And this week, a little farther back, in 1971, Mariner 9 becomes the first Mars orbiter. Are you ready?
We're going to get some help from the crowd, as we often do.
All right, on three, enthusiastically. One, two, three.
Rainbow Space Chats!
Oh, that was good.
Well done, well
Thank
done.
You.
Did you bring shirts for everybody?
No, I thought you did. I think they're in the back of Matt's car. He said he'd give them to you after the show.
We'll put them in the mail.
There you go. So, usually this is where I give a space-related fact, and in fact, I consider Planetary Radio to be space-related. Planetary Radio has had more than 500 unique shows, has had hundreds of unique guests, airs on 150 radio stations and Sirius XM, and is available via podcast. It's had 101 reviews on iTunes, of which 97 are 5-star, and the other 4 are 4-star.
I want the names of those 4.
And every single show has been produced, edited, and hosted by the man next to me, Matt Kaplan. Please give this man a round of applause.
Space and radio, I'm very nearly the luckiest man on Earth.
That's nice. Shall we go on to the trivia contest?
Yeah, let's do that. Do you remember what you asked 2 weeks ago?
I do indeed. I asked, what's the orbital period of Ceres, the dwarf planet asteroid used to be a planet? And how'd we do?
We did very well because we had a 10th anniversary prize to give away, and that always encourages a big reaction. So we had about double the normal number of entries in this. I want to say that special prize of a Celestron First Scope Telescope with the accessory kit is going to this week's winner, chosen by random.org, Pat Foster, a regular listener but has not won in well over a year. I couldn't really even tell if he'd ever won. But Pat said the orbital period of Ceres is roughly 4.6 years.
That is indeed correct.
Excellent.
Hanging out in the asteroid belt.
Pat, we're going to put that telescope in the mail to you very soon. I do want to mention that we got from lots and lots of people like Mark Wilson. They said, you know, what is the orbital period? It's 1 Syrian year, actually.
That is correct. I really need to remember to specify units.
David Kaplan pointed out that it has been 2.17 Syrian years that Planetary Radio has been on the air, and I'm sure it's very popular on Sirius.
And I'm sure it is. We'll have to have a 3 Syrian year anniversary.
There is one other that I'm playing with my papers here because you just have to hear this. This is really pretty cool. The question was from Kurt Lewis in Missouri City, Texas. Mm-hmm. He wanted to know, if he wins the first scope, will he be able to actually use it to see the dwarves that live on Ceres?
That's going to require a much larger telescope.
Sophisticated audience. It's a dwarf planet, people. You wondered where all the munchkins went, right?
I want no part of this.
Go ahead and give them the next contest, the new one, and then we'll have a couple of more things to give away.
All right, as I mentioned, now Planetary Radio airs on 150 radio stations, as well as Sirius XM. But what was the first radio station to air Planetary Radio? So non-internet, first radio station, go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter. And it aired the only radio station to air the very first episode.
You have until Monday, November 26th at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us that answer.
What are we giving them, Matt?
What?
What are we giving them?
Well, we can give them a shirt, but we also have those great New Year in Space calendars to give away.
That's
and they're
true.
Really cool, the big, large format ones. I think we should give away one of those.
All right. Year in Space wall calendar. New item. Really cool.
We have some other stuff to tell you about that we're going to give away. For our 10th anniversary, we asked people to send us their greetings. A lot of people who just wrote to us and said congratulations. Many more people who sent us special stuff. Here's one of them, Steve Lehman. He left a message on our Planetary Radio 10th anniversary line. A lot of other people did too, but his was the only one that was both multilingual and even interstellar.
Matt, Steve Lehman from Charlottesville, Virginia, wishing you a happy 10th birthday. And in Latin, Felix sit decimus natalis dies, and in Klingon, happy birthday.
So, nice. Kapla, Steve Lehman. And we got to send him a shirt.
Very nice. Let's send him a shirt.
That's our runner-up. Now, there were lots of other cool things. James Newberg created a cool 10th anniversary graphic, and we got to put that on the website somewhere. We'll try and have that up by the time people hear this. But our grand prize, and what a cool prize, of Bill Nye's greeting on your answering machine. In other words, people will hear Bill when they call your phone, goes to Corey Chapman. Corey created this little beatnik tribute to our show.
In a world of cluttered airwaves, full of meaningless chatter, we are thankful for a radio show that truly matters. Not an arbitrary commentary of contrary opinions on this or that, but an enlightening discussion of a scientific fact.
WHFR.
If you have a thirst for knowledge and exploring the cosmos, there is only one place you need to go to find out what you need to know. To the cosmic dignitaries of a show most extraordinary, the visionary, revolutionary, dare I say necessary, happy 10th anniversary to Planetary Radio.
OMG, does he deserve a prize or not? And with